The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to contact us, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at News Talk Science. We get to all of those comments later on in the podcast. Coming up on this week's episode, we'll be speaking to Professor Lewis Dartnell about that amazing news that scientists have discovered a weird gas in the atmosphere of Venus that they just can't explain. Is it aliens? Probably not aliens. Is it aliens? We'll be finding out in a few minutes' time. But first, it's time to look back at some of the smaller stories from the past week. And joining me via Skype is Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen. You're both very welcome. Our first story.
Now, Homer, this is a new body fat analysis test. I start you jiggling and measure how long it takes to stop.
Woohoo! Look at that blubber fly!
Yes. Nurse, cancel my 1 o'clock.
Ruth, is about brown fat. I have to say, I've heard about brown fat a couple of times, and it's one of those things that I go, oh yeah, and then I forget about completely. Is brown fat important?
Well, brown fat is probably very important, and it's something that scientists only discovered about 10 years ago, but it suddenly sort of got a lot of hype in the media because it seemed to be associated with obesity and metabolism. And in fact, there was a film made, I don't know if either of you saw it, it was about a story in the 1980s about an Icelandic fisherman whose boat capsized and he fell into water of about 5 degrees. And he should have only survived for about 20 minutes, but he managed to survive for about 5 or 6 hours, apparently unaffected. And when they looked at him afterwards, they did studies on him and they realized his fat was quite different from what we would see usually in people. And they sort of said it was like seal fat. It was dense and had a different look and composition. But in fact, we've realized that people have all sorts of different kinds of fat in their body. So most of us have that white fat. If you grab that lump around your tummy, that's mostly white fat. And it's big oily lumps that store energy and keep you warm. And it's really important, but obviously too much of it is not good. And we hear all about that, particularly about the white fat that sits around our organs. That's not good for us. But brown fat was discovered in newborns, and that's where we always thought it was. And because babies don't have their muscles fully developed, they can't shiver, so they use brown fat to stay warm, because what brown fat does is it burns up energy and creates heat. And until about 10 years ago, scientists thought that only babies had brown fat. But now we know that lots of people have brown fat. We don't quite now know how much brown fat people have. But what we do know is that people with more brown fat seem to be slimmer and seem to be less likely to develop conditions like diabetes. So these scientists who work in Harvard in an amazing institute, that's the Joslin Diabetes Center, all they work on is diabetes in this Harvard Institute. And what they were looking at to see was, could we increase the amount of brown fat in people, since it seems to have this beneficial effect? And over the last number of years, scientists have looked at drugs and things that might do this, but they haven't come up with a way to do it yet. So here the scientists use a technology that we've talked about quite a few times on the program, CRISPR-Cas9. And they took white fat cells, or the progenitors of white fat cells, from humans, and they changed a gene in them that helps them to turn into brown fat cells, and they injected them into mice with no immune systems. And what they found was the cells developed into brown fat cells and seemed to have beneficial effects in the mice. So
wow.
They put on less weight, they were better able to process sugar, glucose in their bodies. So it was a really exciting study.
Amazing. And for someone who's literally had 3 slices of cake already today, that is good news. I obviously hate the idea of quick fixes to things, because we talk about the advice always being more exercise, better eating. But is it possible that a therapy could come from this to inject into your white blood cells and make you...
I mean, the likely route for a therapy is this idea that you would take cells out of a person's body, and white fat cells, and you would modify them and put them back in. Now, we've seen that type of technology used in some very, very specific disease therapies. Now, they're very, very expensive.
It's not a pre-wedding therapy.
It's not sort of a week before the wedding. No. Okay. This is like half a million per dose. But I think what's interesting is they're looking at how they could use this technology in other ways. So could they make generic cells that are protected from your immune system and give those to anybody? That would be much cheaper. Or could they actually give you a drug that would make your own white cells convert better into brown fat cells in your body. I think, you know, one of the things that people are talking about now, and that's also interesting about brown fat, is that cold helps you make brown fat. So it does seem like you need to spend a good few hours in the cold, but possibly even sleeping with your thermostat down a few degrees at night might make you create more brown fat. And certainly there are some devotees of sea swimming and cold water showers that also think that increases your brown fat. So that might be another way to boost your metabolism.
It's never easy, is it? It's just not easy. Shane, our second story has to do with this controversial marshmallow test that we hear about every once in a while in this program.
Yeah, perhaps the marshmallow test is the best known psychology experiment that's been carried out. It was carried out in the 70s in Stanford, where children were offered two choices. They could have one marshmallow now, or if they were willing to wait for 15 minutes, they could have two marshmallows. And the study followed these children, and 10 years, not literally, but 10 years after they did that initial experiment, they looked at where they had all gone in life. And they concluded that those children who had willpower and could wait had better outcomes as measured by their body mass index, their educational attainment, etc. Now, I'll come back to what I think about that in a moment. But the study that was published just recently from UC San Diego and Shenzhen in China, followed 273 Chinese children between the ages of 3 and 4. And they repeated that 1970 Stanford test with an additional layer of complexity. Some of the children were told that their teachers would find out how long they had waited. Others were told that their friends, their peers, would find out how long they had waited. And the remaining group were told, nobody's going to know what you did. And they found that children who were aware that somebody would look at how long they'd waited managed to wait longer. And if their teacher was looking, they waited the longest. And the conclusions of this study, which are in Psychological Science, are that they say it's surprising that 3 and 4 year olds care so much about what other people think. I don't have a 3 and 4 or 4 year old, but I'm not surprised at that at all, particularly if they're in preschool where they'd have a person who's in a position of authority that they wouldn't want that person to like them.
Yeah.
But look, let's get back to the marshmallow test. It's, as I said, it's famous, if not infamous at this stage, because it is the classic example of the irreproducible psychology test. So the original test was done in a very different time. Ethics was really different back then. So in the 1970s, the children who were tested were all the children of the professors working in Stanford. So talk about a homogenous group. There were only 90 children. And when the study was repeated by sociologists from New York many years later, with a far greater group and much greater diversity of group, they found, and I would say unsurprisingly, that socioeconomic factors were far more dominant in determining where people went after 10 years, not the willpower thing. What I think is important here is the use of science, in inverted commas, to do these things. I'd be very careful. I wouldn't say psychology is not a science, but I would be very cautious about reducing something like willpower to something that you can measure as on or off in an experiment. I think that's very difficult to do. And I think that if something is so hard to measure in science, then the most important thing you can do is reproduce your experiment. And if an experiment is not reproducible, then it's not falsifiable. And I would go as far, perhaps in the comfort of being a physicist, to say it's not really scientific. Now, I put the caveat there is in science is not the only way to understand the world. I say this again and again on this program. There's so many other ways, like personal experience is a perfectly valid way to understand the world. I don't understand why groups of people seek to use the tools of science to understand the motivations of young people with regard to, you know, marshmallows in school, etc. I think that perhaps a more nuanced and interdisciplinary approach would be far better to understanding why children make decisions when they're 3 and 4.
Yeah, and you can imagine the sort of commentary that comes in the media off the back of this sort of story does not probably reflect what the scientists are saying themselves.
No. And let's face it, hunger has got to play a part there too.
Ruth, our third story has to do with smoking. This is not good news for some people.
I mean, I don't know. Again, we can look at the detail here. But you know, Jonathan, you get frustrated with us when we come onto this program and talk about science and we say, but more work has to be done. Well, this is a group of scientists looking at whether smoking is good or bad for you. And I think I can pretty definitively say no more work needs to be done. we know the outcome here. So this is work that was done again in the States in Columbia University Medical Center in New York, and it was looking at the difference between people who smoke heavily and what they called social smokers. And what they found was even social smoking had very, very serious impacts on health. In a way, I mean, as you say, the headline is it's bad news, and it's bad news for people who classify themselves as social smokers. I mean, in some ways it is, and in some ways it isn't. I mean, what they classified as social smokers, I'm not sure it's a definition that we would use here in Ireland. It's people who smoked up to 10 cigarettes a day. I think we tend to use the term more for people who are sort of sporadic smokers. So I would actually think these people were quite regular. Well, they were certainly regular, and I would call them quite heavy smokers. So they compared people with fewer than 10 cigarettes a day and those that smoke more than 20 a day, and they classified those as the heavy smokers. I mean, this isn't entirely new work, but I think what's different here is it's a longitudinal study, and it looked at nearly 20,000 people from a multi-ethnic, diverse sample across the US, and it followed those people for 17 years. So it was a big sample, well-controlled for other different factors. So I think those are two good things, which we didn't see in the study Shane was talking about there. And what it found was that these social smokers were 2.5 times as likely to die of respiratory disease and nearly 9 times as likely to die as lung cancer compared with non-smokers. Now, for the heavy smokers, those figures are far, far worse. So I suppose what it tells us again and again and again, smoking's not good. And absolutely the best thing to do is quit.
Okay, and our final story, Shane, I'm sure you'll love this as someone who's a keen advocate of developing young minds and learning. Researchers have looked at applying electricity in order to improve reading in dyslexic people.
Yeah, and like anyone who's a fan of Victorian science would be able to, actually, or 20th century science would be able to tell you that putting electricity into people's brains isn't always the best idea. I always get this image of some doctor with their new fancy battery and going, sure, what do I do with this? You know, in this study, they electrically stimulated the brains of dyslexic people, and they wondered if it might help improve their ability to read. So the dyslexia is something that affects many people. As many as 1 in 10 in Ireland and the UK are said to have dyslexia. And it's a learning difficulty associated with recognizing sounds that make up words, and then associated with that, your ability to read and to spell. And a possible cause, I stress the word possible cause, for dyslexia is something called phonological deficit, which basically means your ability to process those sounds is somehow, and this is their word, deficient. They say that's associated with an irregularity in neural activity. And so that neural irregularity is what the electricity here is being used to improve or to regularize. And so they took people, 15 of whom have dyslexia and 15 of whom do not have dyslexia, and they applied for 15 minutes a low frequency alternating current. And they said that the processing ability for those who had dyslexia was seen to improve, and the change for those who have no dyslexia was minimal. So it's sort of the beginning of work here. So they haven't actually, applied an electric current, and then all of a sudden people who found it challenging to read could read. They just said they were able to regularize the neural rhythms that they associate with the cause of dyslexia. So there's an awful lot of pieces to be put into this jigsaw for it to turn into a therapy or to turn into something that's useful.
it's sort of smacks of, ooh, this is a sexy new idea. Let's see how it works with the area I'm working in. I mean, this idea of transcranial stimulation has been around for a while, and various reports of the military using it, or other people using it, even people at home trying it to improve their concentration levels or even intelligence in some case. I wonder what the utility is of something like this, and whether or not we're ever going to likely see someone sitting down and getting a blast of electricity to improve their dyslexia for a brief period of time. I mean, if it were to relieve dyslexia in someone who lives with it dramatically, then I suppose there's a justification for it. But I don't know. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I'm normally quite skeptical about these things. You give me two stories this week that really show my scientific skepticism. Yeah. Dyslexia is something that can be quite debilitating. However, I would say it's more the inflexibility of things like examination systems and spelling regimes that are the trouble, really. It's not the you know, the fact that people are somehow deficient.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland, thank you both very much. On the way, is there life on Venus? Yes, this is Future Brief on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. Now, on Monday, many of us will have received alerts and pushes from news media outlets with some pretty stunning headlines. Potential sign of alien life detected on inhospitable planet, and so on and so on. Needless to say, it's an exciting time for astronomers across the world. But what exactly is going on in the upper clouds of Venus? And why is the discovery of a gas called phosphine so important? Professor Lewis Dartnall, Professor of Astrobiology in the Department of Life Sciences at University of Westminster, joins us back on the programme. Welcome back, Lewis.
Hi, Jonathan. Thank you very much for having me on again.
I'm imagining that my reaction to this news headline is probably... It was probably different to your reaction. What happened on Monday?
You sounded quite excited just then.
Well, I was excited, but it's never aliens, is it?
Yeah, no, and I think you're probably right about that as well. So what actually has been discovered, what we know, is that a team of radio astronomers observed Venus, and they found the telltale fingerprint, the signature of a weird gas molecule called phosphine in the atmosphere, in the cloud decks of Venus. Now, that in itself is something of a surprise. Phosphine is a reactive kind of gas. It shouldn't have been able to build up in the air on Venus without being removed. And so the team went through every single known chemical process that can create phosphine, whether that is volcanic eruptions or sort of chemistry driven by sunlight, or perhaps it fell in with meteorites. And they've effectively crossed out one by one every known pathway on their list, that there is no known chemical process that can produce that phosphine. So at the very least, what we've discovered is some new chemistry, some chemical process that was previously unknown about, and possibly that is biochemistry. Perhaps we've just seen our first evidence, the first wisps of very extremophilic, very hardy, high altitude, acid loving bacteria that have colonized and living inside the sulfuric acid droplets and the clouds of our next door neighbor planet in Venus. So it's somewhere on a spectrum between interesting to atmospheric chemists and profound for everyone, because we found life beyond our own planet. And it's somewhere between those two.
I don't want to go too much into down this particular path, but there are organisms that survive some pretty extreme environments, things like tardigrade, for example. There are some life forms that do well, even though the conditions are pretty inhospitable for other animals.
You were absolutely right. And this whole category of survival superheroes, of organisms we found on Earth that can tolerate and thrive under incredibly extreme, inhospitable conditions, are called extremophiles, extreme lovers. And this is my own field of research. I study particular kinds of extremophiles. And when we study harsh environments on Earth, we find life living in boiling hot, acidic conditions in volcanic lakes, or freezing cold conditions, or very high radiation environments. And the expectation might be, therefore, that acid-loving organisms could survive in the acidic clouds of Venus. We found life in sulfuric acid on Earth. The problem with Venus, though, is that it's really, really acidic, perhaps too acidic to be survived by anything we found on Earth. So the detection of phosphine is both very interesting, but also something of a puzzle. There's actually good reason to suspect that maybe Venus could never be alive. There could not be life in those upper cloud decks. So maybe what this result actually tells us is that when we previously thought phosphine would be a good sign of life on other planets, and it's on the list of what we'd be looking for in Earth-like planets orbiting other stars in the galaxy, perhaps we should just cross that out. Perhaps Venus, in fact, is a good counterexample of how you could have phosphine, but no life there to have released it.
Right.
The phosphine in Earth's atmosphere is largely from bacterial production, from microbial production, from life here. Maybe we should rule it out as a biosignature for life on other planets.
Ah, okay. So rather than it being useful as a sign of life, it's actually gone the opposite way and reduced the possibilities of life elsewhere on planets, and probably shut off a few of our potential environments. What exactly is phosphine? What is it made of?
Well, it's a simple compound. It's phosphorus with three hydrogens bonded to it. It's pH3. And phosphine is present in trace amounts in Earth's atmosphere. It's given off by certain kinds of microorganisms, that kind of microbes on Earth, or it's created industrially. You know, we've worked out industrial chemistry. Factories can make phosphine. But importantly, there's no known natural process, no geological process that makes phosphine, which is why it was thought to be a telltale indicator of biology, of life, until this confusing result from Venus. We seem to have found a sign of life in a place where probably life is not possible because of the extreme heat and acidity.
Do you have a theory, or is it really beyond the realms of chemists today to figure out, okay, if it's not biological life, what weird chemistry would have to happen to create this, or do we not even have a clue about that yet?
Well, I think this is a really good example of how science is done, what happens, that you have a team of scientists who discover something which they can't explain. And this team has spent a lot of time and effort working through all of those possible chemical reactions to rule them out one by one, and then say, look, guys, check our working. We've published our results. This is what we've discovered. This is what we found, the phosphine. This is why we don't think it could have been produced through chemical reactions that we know about. What do you guys think? Has anyone got any better ideas? Can anyone disprove this or in fact support it? So at the moment, it's very much a big question mark. You know, some of the best chemists around the world will now be trying to understand how phosphine could be produced under these acidic conditions if it's not by life. But what I hope will also be spurred on by this discovery is some more exploration of Venus. The best way to find out where that phosphine is coming from is to go there, is to send a space probe to Venus to get a close-up look, perhaps some kind of probe dangling beneath a balloon as it drifts through the upper cloud layers, gets blown around by the Venusian winds, and tests those acidic droplets in the clouds.
I want to talk about going there in a bit, but actually, before we get there, apart from the acidity, it's actually, you know, as planets go, a pretty nice place to be, well, theoretically, for life.
Depends on what you mean, I guess. So you definitely do not want to ever find yourself on the surface of Venus. On the ground on Venus, it is hot enough to melt lead, to melt metal, and the pressure would crush you instantly. The atmosphere is so thick on Venus that it is simply and definitely not a habitable place to find yourself on the ground. But just with Earth, if you were climbing a mountain, the higher you go, the cooler it gets. So there's a particular range of altitudes high up in the Venusian atmosphere, where the temperature is actually pretty pleasant. You know, it's room temperature. It's 20 degrees Celsius, 30 degrees Celsius.
T-shirt weather.
T-shirt weather. If you didn't mind your skin and flesh being dissolved by concentrated sulfuric acid raining down on you, because although the temperature is pretty pleasant, it's T-shirt weather, the droplets in the clouds on Venus are incredibly concentrated sulfuric acid. But well, Venus is...
Would they just go... I mean, if... Are we talking about concentrations that it would just, like, go straight through you like an alien?
Yes.
Oh, really?
Of,
wow.
Kind
okay.
of like that. Cool. So, pH 0, pH minus 1, incredibly acidic conditions. Pretty much concentrated 90-95% pure sulfuric acid. There's very little water in those droplets, which in effect is itself a problem. Life is needed to be based on water, aside from the issue of it being very acidic.
Okay, so obviously, and it's important, I suppose, to point this out, because however the media have portrayed this story, it's not like the researchers involved, say, came out and said, look, we found aliens. They said, look, we can't explain this. It's weird. Help us out and understand it. Mm. And I think that's a really important point to make. It's how the media run it and how scientists run it might be slightly different. And it is exciting to think about it possibly being biological life. But my question is, how do we know that it's actually a phosphine in the first place? Because am I right in saying we haven't sent probes there to get samples of what's in the clouds of Venus?
So Venus is our next door neighbor planet. It's, you know, the other side of the Earth from Mars. It's one planet closer to the sun. And it is a place we have explored. We've sent orbiters, satellites to Venus. Probes have gone down through the atmosphere and landed onto the surface and landed and survived a very short period of time before they were crushed by the pressure and the heat. But you're right, this particular detection of phosphine isn't because we sent a probe there to, you know, to do some kind of chemistry test on the droplets there. We've made that discovery remotely, that the team of astronomers are radio astronomers, and they used an entire set of radio telescopes called ALMA. And looking at the spectrum, looking at the sort of wiggly line you get back when you look at Venus with this telescope, they saw a dip, what's known as a line in the spectrum, at about a micron. So about the wavelength that phosphine gives you a spectral fingerprint. So the short answer is we know it's phosphine because we've seen the spectral fingerprint of phosphine when we looked at Venus. And the authors of this paper said there's no other compound that gives you a line, a dip in the graph at that exact position. So
right.
They're confident that they've identified phosphine. The follow-on studies will be to confirm that by trying to identify other spectral features of phosphine, or ideally by not doing this remotely down a telescope, as I say, but by going to Venus with a dedicated mission into that cloud layer and do some proper close-up in-situ science.
On the back of this discovery, how quick could we pack our bags and head off to Venus to get a sample and confirm whether or not this is a biological result?
Well, we'd still be talking about years in the future. So space exploration is relatively slow moving, partly because it takes a long time to travel across space to get between the planets. You know, the solar system is relatively big in that sense. But also you have to go through rounds of proposing a particular mission, getting it approved in a budgetary review, getting the funding for it, designing it precisely, physically constructing it and, you know, bolting the metal together and then putting on the pointy end of a rocket. So I don't think there'll be a mission to Venus in the next 5 years, hopefully in the coming, you know, perhaps within the next 10 years. Even though there's now a really exciting case to go back there and have a much closer look. I think you need to learn to be patient, particularly as a space scientist.
Are there not missions already planned to go to Venus?
As I say, we visited Venus a number of times in the past, but I think I'm right in saying there is not currently a mission on the drawing board that has been funded to go back to Venus just yet.
Yeah, I think there are one or two being talked about. I think NASA has a short list, but it's yet to be decided. And again, if it hasn't been funded or approved, we are talking quite some time before we get, what's it called? Wheels up. Before we get wheels
which
up.
Is kind of like an aircraft thing. I think it would be more kind of blast off or lift off, I guess, for a rocket, for a space mission.
Yeah, I was using it as a metaphor, Lewis. There's no need to be picky. So let's finally then talk about the reaction to it. When you read the story, how did you react? And do you think the media maybe oversold this a little bit? And do you have a problem with that?
Yeah, as I said, I was pretty excited by this discovery, by this announcement, even though my suspicion will be that it will turn out to be some unknown atmospheric chemistry rather than biochemistry and life. But on the whole, actually, I think the media response, at least what I've seen of it, has been pretty responsible. It's been an excited response, but it's not been pushing the boat out too much. It's not been speculating too much. I haven't seen life on Venus definitely found type headlines, because I think we have the story comes up every now and then of water discovered on Mars or life found on Mars, and you know, it's a discovery of that magnitude is going to take a lot of hard work, and we would need to confirm it and corroborate it with several different observations and experiments, and that would be just the same that would be true of Venus. If there was life there, we'd have to confirm it with different lines of evidence to know with certainty that it's there.
Exactly how much evidence do you need to say, yes, we've got aliens? I'm thinking of that phrase, extraordinary claims. Mm. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. How much do you think we'd need for the scientific community to say that is definitely alien life, wherever it might be, Lewis? What sort of burden of proof is required, do you think?
What would probably be required, I think, for a confident detection of life on Venus or indeed on Mars, would be a sample return mission. So what we do at the moment with exploring Mars and the other planets and moons is effectively take a entire laboratory of different chemical and astrobiological experiments and instruments, and we shrink them down so they can fit in something the size of a shoebox, and make them very low weight, very low size, very low power demands. So you can fit them into the point end of a rocket, whether that's on a set of wheels from Mars rover or give it a balloon to dangle beneath if we're going to Venus. We effectively shrink an entire laboratory and send it to the place we're trying to explore to do the tests and experiments there, to do them in situ, it's called. But ideally, what you'd want to do is go to Mars or Venus, grab handfuls of the most interesting and promising samples, and then bring them back to the Earth so you can use every laboratory around the world, the absolute cutting edge, best, state-of-the-art, sophisticated instruments to scrutinize that sample and then be confident that there is a biosignature in there, that you've got different lines of evidence. So with either Mars or Venus, I don't think we'll be able to reliably and confidently say, yes, we have found signs of life there, without first bringing a sample back to the Earth so we can test it in many, many different ways.
Yeah, or I mean, I suppose if they made first contact and that was pretty clear, that would also be another way.
If they send us an interplanetary tweet, I yeah. think you're right.
If a UFO appears in the sky, which would also be very cool.
Which would be very cool.
Brilliant speaking with you. Professor Lewis Dartnall, Professor of Astrobiology at University of Westminster. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
He's great, isn't he, Lewis? You can find him on Twitter, by the way. It's at Lewis_Dartnall. That's Lewis, L-E-W-I-S, and Dartnall, I suppose, how you would ordinarily spell it. Okay, looking back at some of your comments and texts from last week's show, and I should point out producer Aidan McKelvey is off this week, so it'll just be sort of a bit of a monologue as we go through these. I hope that's all right. But we do say we try and reach everything that we're texted to get back to you on your thoughts on what we talked about. And we were discussing the case of Dr. Iwi Nihuluwon in UCD. She suffered sexual harassment from a colleague over the course of about 2 years. MW in Mayo says, as usual, emphasis is on the harassment rather than on those who allowed it to continue for years. Shame on the untouchable UCD authorities. Time to name and shame, but of course not on our media. I don't have those details to hand as to who was responsible for handling the case, and I don't have the ins and outs of it. And I think Dr. Nihulawan is engaging with the university herself, and we have heard the president saying that he's going to respond. The minister Harris's response and new appointment to the board, all of these things may obviously need to turn into something positive. That changes the culture, but the details of who may or may not have mishandled the case, I don't have access to, and so for that reason, I'm not going to start throwing out names. They also say academic subjects is a diversion. Harassment happens everywhere. It does indeed, but I suppose what I wanted to get to, and I'm not sure we fully did in such a short space of time, but what I wanted to ask is, is there something about academia that makes it more difficult to report? And are there the same sort of supports and avenues for people to find support in academia compared to elsewhere? But yes, it is something that happens everywhere, obviously. Another says it's not discussed because it then does not exist. Once discussed, it can't be swept under the carpet again. That's one of, echoing Evie Nihulavon's comments of saying that we've got a very bulgy carpet, I think was her quote. And quite rightly, admirably, she's sort of shone a light on this through her own experiences. Another says, but sure, men will say that's why women go to college looking for sexual favors or sexual encounters. I hear men say it all the time that what university is for is drink and sex. Look, what men say trying to be funny, if we were all to be hung by the stupid comments we make, then I think a lot of us would be in trouble. I think men, particularly younger men, say things without sometimes realizing the implications of those and thinking perhaps, oh, this is harmless. And also sometimes they say stupid things that they don't fully mean if you're to ask them in the cold light of day. Banter is this sort of umbrella excuse that's used sometimes for really toxic language and so on. But otherwise, just saying something stupid. I think the men who say, the only reason why women go to university is for sex and drink, does that even bear a response for people who actually hear that? It's a ridiculous comment. An anonymous texter says, harassment and its associated behavior was very prevalent where I work. Universities will not act due to power imbalances, but also due to the fact that those perpetrating the behavior are almost indispensable due to the research output. Well, this is one of those, one of the reasons we wanted to talk about this is you know, if someone is bringing in a lot of funding because of their research, if they're a very powerful professor and well known in the field, if they're contributing, and will the scandal be that much bigger because of their profile? Is that why things are sometimes swept under the carpet? You would hope that is not the case. But this person says, I suffered this behavior for 10 years in a national university. Nothing was done. I was told I had to make a formal complaint against my head of department. Not very likely. Yeah. And one of the outcomes we were looking at was, you know, should we be having independent bodies that are not in any way linked to the victim or the harasser? Look, it's not something that we're going to solve in one day. And it's not something that we look to do in the program, to be honest. You know, whether or not to cover this was something that I had to think about, because we've always tried to stay away from policy, from those sort of things, because we really want to just talk about science. But then every once in a while, something comes along and you say, look, this is about science. It's about how we do science, and it affects the level and quality of science that gets done, because in some cases, women experience, and also men, but mostly women experience these sort of conditions that make it impossible for them to compete with male scientists. And we have that loop that we see that's been around since men went to work and women stayed at home. That's it from us for this week on the podcast. Hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back with more in the podcast feed, I think on Tuesday, with a brilliant piece on blackfish and their amazing adaptation that allows them to absorb 99.5% of light. It's a really good piece. Producing this week was Aid McKelvey and Simon Keane. On research was Garrett Mahal and Stephen Daunt. On sound was Stephen McLean. We'll see you very, very shortly in the podcast feed. In the meantime, stay curious.